Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Washington, D.C., and was a water boy for a construction crew at age 13. He became an All-American basketball player at Syracuse, played 12 years in the NBA, and was elected to the Basketball Hall of Fame. His number 21 was the first number ever retired by the Detroit Pistons. He formed the Bing Group in 1980, which now has 1,400 people, and is now partnering with Bob Thompson on a charter school. His name, Dave Bing, and I'm Jack Prasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Prasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to Dave Bing, the founder and chairman of the Bing Group. Dave, welcome. It's an honor.
Thank you very much, Jack. Good being here.
Can we start by you talking about your childhood and your mom and dad?
I had a very good childhood, a very happy childhood. I'm very blessed to have the parents that I had. My parents are from South Carolina. They were farmers as they were growing up. And when they got married, they moved to Washington, D.C. I think the only negative that they would reflect on was the opportunity that they didn't have to finish school. Both my parents finished the eighth grade. My dad was a contractor. He was a bricklayer. And he gave me, I think, a lot of the work ethic that I have today. Because of the lack of education or the opportunity for education, it was important in our household that the children, I have three siblings and I'm the second oldest, but my parents stressed to us how important education was going to be in our lives and wanted to make sure that we got good grades and we did the things that we were supposed to do in school. My dad and mom were very religious. I can remember as a kid growing up when I had to go to church more often than I wanted to. But I think, once again, in retrospect, it helped to make me who I am today because I have a strong faith. And I think the two careers that I've been in, sports, you have to have a strong faith. And I think now, as a business person, especially in the automotive industry, you'd better have a lot of faith.
What was the first job you ever had?
First job I had, I had just turned 13, and I was feeling myself and asked my dad, could he help me get a job? So he took me out to the construction site, and I was hired as a water boy. And my job was to give water to the laborers and the bricklayers. And I did that for two summers, and then I progressed and became a laborer. After about a year of that, I progressed again and became a bricklayer apprentice. And it was a great experience, and it was something that I thought I wanted to do because my dad did it, but he made it very clear to me that that's not what he wanted. He didn't want that for me. He didn't want me to do what he was doing because it was very physical, it was very difficult. It's a seasonal kind of occupation. And even though D.C. Doesn't get truly too cold for too long, there are a couple of months, maybe 3 months out of the year where it's too cold to work. And he didn't want me to go through what he went through.
Did he pay you?
He paid me, but he wanted to take it back. I can remember getting my first paycheck, and my dad thought I should give it to him because head of the household from the old school, he's supporting me and said, you know, I need this money too. And I had a real problem with that. And fortunately, my mother interceded, and I did get my paycheck. Wasn't a lot, but I did get my paycheck, and it was a great feeling to be able to go to the bank and cash that paycheck.
Can you talk about the injury at age five?
Yeah, the neighborhood that I grew up in wasn't surely not an affluent neighborhood. And there were a lot of kids in the neighborhood, and we didn't have a lot of toys to play with. So we had to make do and make things up to have fun. And one day, we were playing stick horse, and I had nailed a couple of sticks together, and it was my horse. And as we were running, I wound up tripping over a rock and fell on the stick, and a nail hit me in my left eye. And back then, we didn't have the necessary insurance so that I could get an operation for corrective surgery. So I've been able to live with blurred vision in my left eye since 5 years old.
How good would you have been, Dave, if you had two good eyes?
It's hard for me to say. Sometimes I did think about that. But I was blessed to be able to still see and play and have a 12-year professional career. I do think that I would have been a better player had I not had that injury. But one of the things that I reflect on is that because of the injury, it made me concentrate on other phases of the game. And I think it made me a better all-around player.
Were you always a phenomenal athlete?
From the age of, say, 9, 10 years old, it was kind of obvious to people around me that I had athletic ability. I was actually a better baseball player than basketball when I was young. And I played baseball all the way through high school and was actually drafted by the Pittsburgh Pirates and their farm system. But I would have had to go to West Virginia to play in their farm system. And 1962, West Virginia was not a place for me to go. So I concentrated on basketball, and I had a lot of basketball scholarships. So I wound up going to Syracuse University.
Why did you go to Syracuse?
Syracuse was the last school I visited. They had a horrendous record. They had lost 27 games in a row in two seasons. And I knew I could only go up. But the primary reason was I was escorted around the campus by Ernie Davis, who had just won the Heisman Trophy, and he was the first African-American to ever win the Heisman Trophy, and I was thoroughly impressed by him.
Who was your roommate in college?
My roommate in college was a guy that I just helped to induct into the Hall of Fame, Jimmy Boeheim, who is now the head coach at Syracuse University. He came there in 62, or we did together, and Jimmy's never left.
You may be the only two college roommates ever in any National Sports Hall of Fame?
We probably are. I went in as a player in 1990. Jimmy went in as a coach last year, and we reflect upon that, and I think both of us take a lot of pride in it.
We're talking to Dave Bing. When we come back, we'll ask him how it is he became a Detroit Piston. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Dave Bing, who was the second overall pick in the 1966 NBA draft. Dave, were you surprised you came to Detroit?
Yeah, I was pretty surprised. I knew I was going to either New York or Detroit, and I was under the impression it would be New York because I'm an East Coast guy. I played in Syracuse and played in the Garden several times in my collegiate career. So I was pretty sure I would go to New York because the other top player was Cassie Russell from the University of Michigan, and you know, it's right down the road from Detroit. So, you know, Cassie felt he was coming to Detroit, and I felt I was going to New York. And when Dave DeBuscher, who was a coach at that time, called heads and it came up tails, New York picked Cassie, and that's how I got to Detroit.
What did you earn that first year?
It's almost embarrassing today based on what the guys are making. My first year as the number two player coming out of college was $15,000. And, you know, you could ask me what, you know, how much I make today. It's not much more than that because I'm an automotive supplier.
So, who was the best you ever played against?
I think the two best players, and it's hard to separate them because they were just great, great players. It would have been Oscar Robertson and Jerry West. In Oscar's case, he was the consummate player who could do everything, and he was ahead of his time because he was just a big guy to play a guard. And Jerry West and I were pretty much the same size. But Jerry just was an unbelievable shooter, and he never got the credit, in my opinion, for being the great defensive player that he was.
If you owned a team and you could take Oscar in his prime or Michael Jordan in his prime, who would you take?
I think I'd probably take Michael Jordan. Once again, when you start talking about the total game, Michael, once again, got a lot of accolades for being a great offensive player, but he was a great defensive player also. And then he's obviously pretty exciting, so he brings a lot of people into the seats.
When did you know you wanted to have your own business, and how did you get started?
I think going even back to high school, I'd always thought about running my own business, because even though my dad didn't have a formal education, he had his own small business in the construction area, and there were nights at home when we'd sit around the table, and he's trying to balance his books, and he's trying to figure out how to pay this bill or that bill, and I started getting energized from that. And so the courses that I took in high school were pretty much business related, and my degree is in economics from Syracuse, so I really stayed on the business track. In the off season, as a player, it was obvious to me I wasn't going to play forever. And I always prepared myself by doing a lot of reading, whether it was on the plane, the bus, the hotel. And I just really tried to prepare myself for the eventuality of retirement from the league. So, and I also worked in the off season. I worked with the National Bank of Detroit for 7 off seasons. I worked for the Chrysler Corporation for 3 off seasons. And I didn't want to be a banker, and I didn't want to be a car dealer. I didn't know what I wanted to be, but I knew what I didn't want to do. And so I was pretty well prepared at the end of my career to go into business. And I wasn't ready to start my own business, but I had a pretty good background and had met a lot of good people to help me.
In 1980, you formed the Bing Group. What is the Bing Group, and what does it do?
The Bing Group is a collaboration of a couple of different companies. The parent company is a holding company. Bing Steel was the first company, and what we do is process steel. We slit steel, the big coils that you would see on trucks. We take that into our plant, put it on some major pieces of equipment, level it out, slit it, which is cutting, rewrap it, and then it goes to another process, which is called stamping, which is the second company that I have. It's called Stamp and Assembly, and we actually make parts for the vehicles, whether they're trucks or cars. And the steel and the parts that we make are not visible to the naked eye. It's mostly the inner bodies and the underbody of the vehicle. The last thing that we do is we had a joint venture with Lear Corporation, and we were the final seat assembly for a lot of the product that goes into Ford, Chrysler, and GM, and Toyota.
In 2005, you employed 1,400 people, and you had $550 million in sales. Which of the big three gave you your first contract, and what was it for?
The first contract I got was from General Motors. General Motors helped me to get started. And my first contract was for about $350,000. And GM helped me by identifying equipment that was obsolete to them but was great for me, and helped me install the equipment in my facility. And we were off and running. And, you know, I owe a lot to GM from its beginning.
You've had a lot of setbacks. Every business has setbacks. Can you talk about the 2 fires in 1999?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to relate with how it happened. It was a Friday afternoon, and I think it was August the 13th. I remember it very well. And I saw smoke coming out of one of my plants on the campus where we are. And so I jumped up and called the fire department. And by the time I ran over to the plant, it was really in flames. And I was really concerned about the employees, making sure that nobody was hurt. And that plant actually burned to the ground. And it was because of a distraught employee, a guy that thought he was going to get fired for some things that he had done. and that was not the case. But we're very lucky that nobody got hurt in that fire. And overnight, this was on a Friday, on a Saturday, Lear, who was my partner in that business, we were able to set up a makeshift plant in another location and did not miss a shipment to our customers. And it was very heroic, but it was very tragic at the same time. The second fire, we don't know what happened. We don't know if somebody set the fire or what, but that was on the east side of Detroit. And that didn't burn the building down, but it did create havoc for a lot of my employees.
Sport magazine once dubbed you Mr. Unsung About. Mr. Mm-hmm. Unsung About. You've been a servant leader. Why?
Well, I think it goes back to the way I was raised. Once again, my parents came from very meager beginnings, and I don't care how much success that I had as a young athlete, or even as I began to get a little older and go at the different levels, high school, college, and pro, they never allowed me to have the big head. I was always, you know, their boy. And, you know, I had a lot of people saying a lot of good things about me, but my parents always kept the right kind of perspective in that you weren't raised that way. You know, don't get this big head. Don't go around thinking that you're better than somebody else just because, you know, you're the star or you make money or you got all of these accolades. You know, don't get concerned about that. And so I never did. And I mean, that's just part of my makeup.
We're talking to Dave Bing, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Dave Bing, who was a member of the NBA's 50th anniversary all-time team. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Let's talk about the legacy cost of the Big Three. What do you say to the person that's worked for 20 years, 30 years, 15 years, when he says, I was promised this, I've earned this, I'm entitled to this, it's wrong. I didn't make the mistakes, it's not my fault.
There's a lot of truth to that, but you can kill the goose that laid the golden egg. And the mentality of entitlement is something that I think we have to just forget in our culture, quite frankly, because we are in a business, in the automotive industry, and in the manufacturing industry, it now has become global. And so those legacy costs are keeping the American manufacturers from being competitive. I agree the people earned it. There were managers who negotiated in good faith, and now it's become a bad deal. It is a burden to those companies, and it's not an easy solution. But if these companies are going to survive, that's something that has to be negotiated and understood. You can't have it all.
The Bing Group is a privately held company, and 19% of the company is owned by other people other than you. A lot of founders and chairmen who have a private company say, I'm taking all the risk, I keep all the equity. Why have you shared 19% with other people?
Because they've helped me get to where I am. It's very simple for me. As an athlete that played team sports, I may have been the star or the high scorer, but I wouldn't have been able to do the things I did had I not had teammates that sacrificed for me. Somebody set a pick to get me open. Somebody passed me the ball when I was open. Somebody covered for me if I made a mistake on defense. And those people very seldom get recognized. The stars and the big names are the ones that are projected to be, you know, number ones. I think it's very important that if you understand what success is about, it's about inclusion. And therefore, I think it was important for those people that gave up careers and that committed to me to help me build the business that they should share in it from an ownership standpoint.
We're talking to Dave Bing, and when we come back, we'll ask him a little more about humility. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're talking to Dave Bing, who was elected to the Basketball Hall of Fame in 1990. Dave, there's a very famous poem by Rudyard Kipling entitled If. And if you will, a couple of little stanzas of that. If you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same. Later he says, and lose and start at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss. Later, if you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue or walk with kings nor lose your common touch. You've lived this. Why?
Jack, I've been blessed. Once again, I think it goes back to the way I was raised. And my parents, good people, just average people, just never looked at themselves. As my dad started to make money in his business, he never changed as a person. As he moved up in the hierarchy of the church, he really never changed. And as I observed my dad, in particular, I watched and I just appreciated the way he was, the way he dealt with people. It didn't matter whether or not you were wealthy or poor. He treated you the same with respect and with dignity. It didn't matter, even in our church, whether it was our minister or it was a kid just running around the church. He dealt with people in a way that he could even chastise you, and you didn't really feel bad about it. And I just tried to emulate him as much as I possibly could.
Everything you do, Dave Bing, is first class. One, why, and what do you say to a young person that says, I can't afford to do it first class now. When I get rich, when I get successful, then I'll do it classy.
Well, my dad, as I was apprentice, as a bricklayer, I remember the first time I had a chance to lay brick. I was on a wall with the guys, and they allowed me to lay brick. And I was really proud that I was doing a good job in my mind until my dad came over and looked at it and pushed the wall over. And it embarrassed me, it hurt my feelings, and when I asked him in private why he did that, he said because it wasn't right. And it was going to be a reflection on us. You do it right or you don't do it at all. And so when you talk about trying to do things the right way, you do it with class. I think I learned that from my dad also. So there are a lot of little lessons that I've been exposed to, some in my family, in my home, some in the neighborhood where I grew up, in the church where I grew up. And I've just tried to live that kind of life. As it relates with people saying, I'll do better when I do better, it's too late. You've got to do it when things are rough. You've got to do it from the beginning. It's either in you or it's not, because people will be able to stand back and see what kind of character you have. And I've always been a high character guy, in my opinion, and I want to treat people right, and I want to be treated right. So trying to do things the right way, the best way that I know how, is just a part of me.
The Super Bowl was a glorious experience for this region. If in 3 to 5 years we look back and say the Super Bowl really transformed how we see ourselves in Southeast Michigan, what will the keys be that made this happen?
I think the thing that was most important was that people learned that we could all work together for a common cause. Our reputations were on the line worldwide. And we have been berated as an area for so long that I think everybody got tired of that. And we wanted to prove the world wrong. And I think we did. But the most important legacy from all of this is that you can do more with people all pulling in the same direction than you can do with people having all of their separate private agendas. The agenda for the Super Bowl was all of us need to work together for the common good of the city of Detroit or for this area. And we did that, And we need to keep doing that. And it's an attitude more than anything else.
You're extremely loyal. You're loyal to your people. You're loyal to Detroit. You're loyal. You were one of the founders of the NBA Alumni Association. Why so loyal?
I'm a people person, and if I like you, if I respect you, then you got a friend for life. My people and my organization is reciprocal. I'm loyal to them because they're loyal to me. I've been in Detroit now for 40 years. This city has been loyal to me, and I want to be able to give back in every way that I can. As far as the NBA is concerned, the retired players were an afterthought because the players that started the league in 1946 never participated in a pension plan. And those are the guys whose shoulders we stood on. And if you forget those people who took all of the hard knocks and got this off the ground for us to live the kind of lives that we've lived, and we forget about them, something is wrong with your character. So I, with another four guys, said we're not going to allow this happen. And we started the Retired Players Association, and it has grown, and it's doing a lot of good for a lot of players. And the league even recognizes it now.
The NBA is a United Nations. You've got players from Bosnia, Yugoslavia, Italy, Brazil, Argentina, China, everywhere. And it works. It's very successful. It's stronger because of that. Why can't businesses and communities do the same thing? Well, what's the key for them to do the same thing?
I think, once again, there's one primary goal in a sport, and that is to win. And it doesn't matter, you know, where you come from, what you look like, what your religion is. None of that matters. Can you play? Can you help me win? And so I think there's a common goal that we all have as an athlete. As far as our communities and as business is concerned, I mean, everybody's got these hidden agendas. And we don't have a common goal. Or if we do, I don't think we work very well together to reach the common goal. And so athletics is a barometer, in my opinion, that if other organizations, be it communities or be it business, can emulate it, they would all be successful.
Another a current project that you have is the North End Project of Detroit, where you're building 40 middle-income brick homes valued at $170,000 to $200,000. Can you talk about that?
Well, I'm in a neighborhood that at one time was a nice middle-class neighborhood. Over the last 40 or 50 years, the deterioration there has just been abysmal. And I think people start to accept the fact that that's the way that they're supposed to live. It's okay. And, you know, people look at homes and communities in the suburbs and say, well, that's the suburbs. My position is, why can't we do it here in the city? Why can't I do it in the community where I work? And so I decided that I was going to do it house by house, block by block. And we started the process, and everybody said I was nuts for doing that because I wasn't going to make money. I didn't do it to make money. I did it to change the attitude more than anything else, to bring pride back to the neighborhood, to say to people, you don't have to live like this. Here's an opportunity. Here's a home that if it were in the suburbs, it would be a $350,000 home. And these people are now moving into these homes and are very proud of them, and I can see the neighborhood starting to change.
We're talking to Dave Bing, and when we come back, we'll ask him about education. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Dave Bing, and the Bing Group was the Black Enterprise Company of the Year in 1998. Dave, can you talk about your partnership with Bob Thompson and the Skillman Foundation?
Well, Bob Thompson is a guy that got maligned for a while here in Detroit because of something that he wanted to do, and that was to take money that he had earned in his business and put it back into education for kids in the city of Detroit. And he had $200 million that he wanted to invest, and there was an uproar, and long story short, he backed away from it. And after about a year, 18 months of back and forth, I decided that the need is so great, and we've got somebody with that kind of capital who want to help. We've got to find a way to make it happen. So I gave him a call and told him I thought he was doing the right thing, that maybe his approach was wrong, and I thought I could help. And I'm on the same page with him. You want to help kids, and that's got to be primary. All the other agendas, once again, came up and hit him in the face. And if the real agenda is to help kids get educated, then we need to be on the same page and make that a reality.
Where is the school going to be and what grades?
It's going to be a high school. It'll be in the north end of Detroit over near where my business is. We have a very, very outstanding elementary school in the area, Loving. There are a couple of good middle schools in the area, but we don't have a high school. And I wanted to make sure that we got a high school in the area because with my business there, with the elementary and middle school doing well, with the neighborhood housing project coming along well, people are starting to move back in, it can become a very vibrant community again. So we're going to have a high school from the 9th grade to the 12th grade. It's going to be a relatively small school with no more than 500 kids. And I believe that's the right kind of environment that kids can learn in because you're going to get the attention that you need.
We had Doug Ross here a few months ago, University Prep, partnership charter school between him and Bob Thompson. And the only two stipulations that Thompson demands is 90% of the kids that start 9th grade will graduate, and 90% of them will go to college, or I fire you and I put somebody else in. That's impossible. That is impossible. Well, how are you going to do that?
We say it's impossible, but if you don't set lofty goals, you never reach them. It may be difficult. I would agree with that, but I don't necessarily agree that it's impossible, and we've got some kids over at University Prep whether 90% of them are going to graduate and 90% of them will go to college. So it can be done. And I think that's a model that works. And if it works there and it's right in the inner city, why can't it work anywhere else in our community? And so I think what Doug is doing is outstanding. And I'm happy to see Bob continue to support him. But he's handed him the gauntlet that if you don't meet these criteria, this is what's going to happen. So nobody wants to fail. Nobody wants to get fired. So you do your very best to ensure that it's not going to happen.
What do you say to the people that say you're cherry-picking the kids, you handpick the kids, and also you're taking jobs away from the teachers' union?
Well, the first one is not true in terms of cherry-picking because it's a lottery process. First come, first serve, anywhere in the city of Detroit. And the school that we're going to build will go through the same kind of process. It's a lottery process. And you've got families that are standing in line waiting to try to get in because they want to be part of something that's successful because they know that that's the right foundation for their children as they move into young adulthood. As far as jobs are concerned, there's no entitlement here. If you're a good teacher, if you're a good educator, you're going to have a job. I think competition is what this is all about. And we live in a very competitive environment here. And if teachers are satisfied being in DPS, for example, and they're worried about losing their job to teachers that may go to a charter school, well, I think competition is good, quite frankly. As an athlete, a former athlete, it brings out the best in you. So if it's good for these kids to compete, to have the opportunity to be a student in that kind of environment, I think it's good for the teachers to compete to get jobs in that kind of environment.
Let's talk about education. How important is an education today?
I think it's extremely important. And if you go back over the last 3 or 4 decades here, at one time, because the automotive industry was so strong, education wasn't that important. You could come out of high school as a dropout and get you a job on the line and make a lot of money. That's not true today. As we can see the downsizing and the exporting of jobs out of Michigan and out of the industry, I think the only way to compete against that is with education. Technology is booming all over the world, and if we miss the boat from an education and technology standpoint, we're going to continue to be a second-rate country, and I don't think we want that. We have a very competitive spirit in this country, and even in this area, and education, I think, is the basis and the foundation of making sure that you can get a better life for yourself.
You once said, and I quote, "Education is the enlightening element and eases racial glass ceilings." What did you mean?
I think a lot of people get caught up in history and say that I can only go so far because I'm black. I can only go so far because I'm poor. The system is against me. You got to knock those barriers down, and I think education is the way to do it. You become exposed to what's truly happening in your community, in the world, through education. And I think with it, it gives you an opportunity to not only break through the glass ceiling, but also to knock barriers down. And I think we have to continue to do that. We have to continue to stress it and not accept mediocrity or the way things used to be. It's a new world. We got to change it. We got to be a part of it.
Speaking of being a pathfinder, you've always been a pathfinder. Syracuse, the Bing Group in 80, now this charter school. Where do you get the courage to do these things? And what do you say to a person that doesn't have courage? How does he or she get courage?
I'm really not sure how you get it, but I would say this. Too many people are afraid to fail. And so they sit back and they do nothing. They try to take a safe path. And if you do nothing, you can't fail. And we've got to get people out of that mindset once again. There's nothing wrong with failing. You failed because you tried to do something. You tried to make a difference. You tried to change. And people just cannot be afraid to take that step out there, not knowing what's around the corner. Once again, if your foundation is steeped in education, you can take on a lot of different challenges that you never thought of. And I encourage our young people to do that. Don't be afraid to fail.
What role has faith played in your life, Dave Bing?
Well, faith has been a major, major contributor to any success that I've had. I think as an athlete, you know, you're only good as your last shot. You know, people cheer for you one day, and they're booing you like heck the next day. You're a winner one day, you're a bum the next day. On the business side, the same thing is true. So I had to have faith in order to be a good athlete because, you know, it's a thin line, and the same thing is true with business.
What advice would you give to a young person today?
I think you have to have the attitude of learning, never giving up, and never accepting mediocrity. So those would be the things that I would try to give to young people.
What are you the proudest of?
I'm proudest of being a good father. I have three daughters, and between my daughters and my three grandchildren, I love them dearly, and I'm very proud that they're proud of me.
Dave Bing, when you were elected in 1990, Oscar Robertson was the one that gave the introduction, and this is what he said. "Dave is the perfect example of professionalism, class, dignity, and humanity. He cares. He gets involved in the world." Amen. Thanks for being you. Thanks for all you've done, you continue to do, and thanks for coming.
Thank you, Jack.
I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because anything is possible. Spall.
Believe in yourself.